From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
With the best all-inclusive vacation deals to Mexico and the Caribbean, booking your getaway with Cheap Caribbean Vacations means you have more freedom to do your deal. Whether you want to enjoy snorkeling, endless margaritas and more, or simply soak up the sun and sand in a tropical paradise, Cheap Caribbean Vacations has your deal for that. Plan and book the exact getaway you want at exactly the right price for you by using our exclusive budget beach finder, or find a featured all-inclusive package to Generations Riviera Maya Resort and do your deal at cheapcaribbean.com.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Thinking sideways.
I don't understand.
Does not compute.
What?
Stories of things we simply don't know the answer to.
Well, hi there. Welcome again to another episode of Thinking Sideways. We're the guys who tackle unsolved mysteries and solve the heck out of them.
Guys?
We're the guys and girls.
Gang.
Sorry.
Gang.
Yeah. So I am joined, as always, by...
Devin.
And...
Steve.
Yeah. And so let's just dive headfirst into another mystery. Okay, before I forget, this is a listener-suggested episode, so I want to give a big shout-out to Ash from England. Thanks, Ash.
Wait, if we're a gang, do we have hand signs?
Duh!
We have hand signs, we have colors, we have guns.
Yeah, it's like this, and then this one.
Oh, the question mark thing with the finger. Yeah, I got it. Yeah.
And there's a bird. Okay. All right, so our mystery this week, Dorothy Arnold. Some of you may have heard of Dorothy Arnold. This is actually... 100 years ago, kind of a huge thing. It got worldwide publicity. Let me talk a little bit about her. Dorothy Harriet Camille Arnold was
the
daughter.
That's a name. Let's talk about that.
I know, grandma and grandma's names or something like that. Mm. Her mother had like 5 names. That's kind of a rich people thing, I think. But anyway, she was the daughter of Francis and Mary Arnold. Francis Arnold was a stinking rich perfume and porter. They lived in a very posh Manhattan house just a block east of Central Park. Very nice part of town. They were listed in the Social Register, which is a big deal for rich people. You guys have probably heard of the Social Register, right?
Oh, I'm on it.
Yeah. Oh, you're on it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not.
Totally.
I'm a 1%er. Dorothy was a socialite. And the definition of socialite is, quote, someone who is well-known in fashionable society and spends a significant amount of time participating in social activities such as parties and other fashionable events. That's from Wikipedia.
Mm.
Parties, by the way, which none of us ever get invited to.
Well, Steve does, obviously.
Yeah, apparently.
Because he's
highfalutin and stuff.
Yeah. On the social register.
I've decided to screw the mystery. I'm going to spend the next hour just ranting about the 1%.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm cool with that.
All right.
How about you?
No.
No.
Oh.
Please.
More mystery?
I think that's done.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
All right. Let's solve the mystery then. Back to Dorothy. On Monday, December 12th, 1910, so 104 years ago, Dorothy left the family house in the morning, saying that she was going to go shopping for a dress.
Her sister's debutante.
Yeah, again, ball. More rich socialite stuff. She was.
It wasn't even her debutante ball.
Yeah, exactly. So she had to obviously go buy a new dress for that.
Of course.
Yeah. Anyway, she left the house to go shopping, and the family never saw her again. And this was a huge deal. I mean, got a lot of publicity, and everybody was wondering what happened.
Yeah, it was all over the newspapers.
Oh, yeah. The family and their investigators were able to piece together her trail, at least some of her trail, of where she went before she disappeared. So first off, she went to a store at 27th and 5th Avenue.
Can we talk about New York and the way that they do streets and how confusing that is?
Yeah,
oh,
I know.
Please, yes, because I still see this, and it still confuses the heck out of me.
At 27th and 5th. What?
Yeah.
It's avenues run one way and streets run the other. Is that correct?
Yeah, kind of like Vancouver, you know. You guys have been to the Couve.
Nope.
Washington?
Vancouver, Washington?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know which one is north south and which one is east west, but it is avenues one way and streets the other. I could literally be on 5th and 5th potentially.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's so dumb.
I know, it is kind of dumb, but it is what it is. I don't think they're going to change.
We've just
us.
Enraged so many New Yorkers.
The way Portland does it is so much better.
I know.
With names of people that nobody knows.
That's okay.
Yeah, I know. Well, so anyway, I've taken the liberty of printing up this map, which I got off of Google. So you can see up in the upper right-hand corner where she started from. And the place where she went to buy, she stopped at a store and bought half a pound of chocolate, which is down here.
Mm-hmm.
Which is 27th and 5th.
Yeah, and that's 2.5 miles away, so she could hoof it. But I didn't mention, by the way, Dorothy was 25 and apparently liked to walk. So she headed south 2.5 miles and then headed back north to a bookstore.
But, you know, like, that's an hour walk, really.
Yeah, it's not that big of a deal.
Not bad.
Yeah.
You've got a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You just walk.
Yeah, she's not in a huge hurry or anything.
So she bought a half a pound of chocolate.
Bought half a pound of chocolate, and then she went to a bookstore. The bookstore is Brentano's, which, by the way, was in an episode of Seinfeld. It was actually a New York landmark bookstore for many, many years before it got absorbed by Borders, and I assume Borders is out of business by now. But
almost, if not.
Actually, yeah, I can't think of the last time I saw a brick-and-mortar Borders.
Yeah.
No.
Barnes & Noble somehow still around. Borders.
I think I've seen Borders in malls, and that's the only place I've seen them, and that was years ago.
This episode of Thinking Sideways podcast brought to you by Borders.
No, brought to you by defunct bookstores.
Yeah. That'll be our next mystery, is where did all the bookstores go?
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, so she stopped at this bookstore and bought a book by somebody you'd never heard of, Jane Calvin something. I did a Google on her. I couldn't find anything. But anyway, apparently she was popular 100 years ago. But she left a paper trail at these stores because she charged her purchases to the family accounts.
Okay.
Both places, right?
Yeah. She had kind of a sweet deal. Her family, of course, as I said, was stinking rich. She got $100 in a monthly allowance, which is the equivalent of $2,440 today, in today's dollars. And, you know, she had to pay, didn't have to pay any rent, didn't have to pay utilities, mm-hmm. didn't have to pay for food. Plus, she could go out shopping and charge things to the family account. So she just
Top of her allowance.
On top of that $100 allowance.
She had, I saw a mention that she had $30 or $40 in her possession at that time, right?
I think the family estimated she left the house with $25 to $35.
Well, yeah, I remember reading this. She had a day or two before gone out with friends, and I think she took her friends to a movie, and then they had gotten food afterwards, and she had gone to the bank and gotten $36 out of the bank, which seems like such a funny number to us today, but then was obviously a large sum of cash.
That was probably $700 or $800
Right, and then they knew how much she should have approximately spent at these locations, so they figured she had about $25
give or
currency
take.
That for that time period on her, which again is a pretty decent sum of money. It's, you know, a couple $100.
But it's not like, you know, run away to the hills, like,
no,
finance the rest of your life money.
No, not quite.
So, you know, it's that weird middle ground.
Yeah.
Anyways, I think that's worth mentioning.
Yeah. More on that later, but okay, anyway, so after the bookstore, she ran into a friend of hers named Gladys King. And they chatted for a bit, parted ways, and this was at about 1:45 in the afternoon, according to Gladys. And that was the last time she was seen by anybody who knew her.
She literally evaporated from the streets
of
New York.
Didn't the story go that Gladys turned around a second time to wave goodbye?
Oh, yeah.
And saw her at 5th and
Well, basically, you know.
A couple blocks away.
or something like that. Yeah, but yeah. And so that was it. So, yeah, she just sort of vanished from the earth into the history books. Over the following months, many people from across the country claimed to have seen her, because after the news got out, people were phoning in tips from all around the country claiming they'd seen her. And the family, being rich, they had a lot of money to actually send detectives out to follow up on all these leads. And so they were mostly followed up on, and none of them panned out, unfortunately. So when she didn't return home in the evening, her parents started calling all of her friends looking for her. Nobody knew what had happened to her. Wow. Now, let me take a break here. Before we launch into more history and theories, here's a few things about her life just before the disappearance. And I'm talking about these things now because they'll have a little bearing later on in the story. Okay, number one, Dorothy was interested in being a writer. And she had actually written two short stories and submitted it to a magazine called McClure's, which I've never heard of, but you know, they're probably gone by now.
Mm.
And they were rejected, which left her feeling a bit depressed, apparently.
Which I just think, Steve and I were chatting about this earlier.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking how, I guess, cute and funny it is, not to be, you know, dismissive of this, the impact that this can have on someone, uh-huh. but how kind of cute and funny it is that she like submitted two papers and they got rejected and she was like, well, shucks, my career as a writer is over.
I know. It's like, yeah, like, I know. You're supposed to have a little bit more persistence.
Yeah. Or, you know, maybe submit to another magazine that might be more uh-huh. interested in your writing style.
Yeah, submit
it
to
seems
Boys
like she
Life.
Was aiming for the top only. Mm. But then again, nah. the, you know, if you do the readings on this, her family knew that she was a writer, so there's all this talk about how they were mocking her for mm-hmm. trying to write.
Yeah.
But McClure's is the only place that I think she submitted two to them and one to another magazine.
Something like that. Not a lot, though.
Let's think about 1910. There are tons and tons of magazines and newspapers and rags around uh-huh. that you can submit to.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I'm not going to cast any aspersions on her, but I think that maybe a bit of her social status told her that she had to only go for these particular ones.
Like, this is the equivalent of the New Yorker.
Right.
Yeah.
I am from the upper class, so I must write for the New Yorker.
I know. Why not write for Field
and
Stream?
I need to cut my teeth, and I'll get my stuff published wherever I can get it published, because yeah. that's the way all of the good writers in this world have gone about it.
Well,
they
and
wrote
clearly,
crap, they got it published by crap people, and eventually they got better.
And clearly her problem was that I'm sure she was sending them on in under her own name instead of a male pseudonym.
Well, that's maybe. Another good point.
It's another point entirely.
I think actually women writers were kind of accepted back in those days.
They were
not so much. Yeah. There were some women writers, but when did suffrage happen? When did the suffrage movement go
through? That was in the 30s.
Yeah, so this is pre all of that.
No. Yeah. I'm sorry, the 1930s?
Yeah.
No. No, it was the early 1900s, late 1800s.
Okay, so but this is when all that's happening, and there is still a huge bit of misogyny is not the right word.
Oh, yeah,
what
is
it? Well, a little bit.
Yeah, it's some of that, and it's the old boy society. It's like men do this, and
yeah.
women clean the house and take care of the children.
And that's why Dorothy was a socialite.
Right.
Because, maybe today she'd actually be doing something useful. Back in those days, you know, you're rich and. You're not expected to actually do anything, like become a dentist or a lawyer or anything like that.
And Devin's got a great point, though, is that as a woman, if she had sent it in under the name of Dawn instead of Dorothy,
yeah.
it might have gotten picked up. They're like, oh, well, Dawn's not that great of a writer, but we'll publish his stuff. It's okay.
Well, whereas the thing about it is, too, is I forget what the title of one of her stories was. It was like
The Lotus.
It was like the Poinsettia and the Flame, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, if you want to sell your story, it should have a title like Pork Chop Hill.
So what we're saying is she should have been submitting to Harlequin.
Yeah. Anyway, so, she gave up, obviously, but although we didn't see the notes. It might have been quite brutal. It's just like... dear Miss Arnold, thanks for submitting your excrescence. Please don't ever do this again. I mean, you don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if when they sent rejection letters, if they actually sent it back all marked up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would crush somebody. If somebody sent back your manuscript and they had taken the time to red pen it.
Mm-hmm. I don't think they did.
I don't think they even return your manuscript. I think they just send you a letter and save on postage.
But that's what I'm getting to the point of... the way that it's portrayed and how strongly she took the rejection, mm-hmm. you would think that somebody had taken the time to red pen all of her work and send it back and say, all of these things are wrong. No, thank you.
Mm-hmm. That, or, you know, she was the daughter of a very wealthy family and was not used to being said no to.
Good point.
Could be.
Very good point.
I mean, just saying.
Yeah.
Or maybe she just was a really bad writer and she just couldn't perceive this, but. Anyway, we're kind of getting off into the weeds here.
Yeah.
All right, so I mentioned her abortive writing career. Also, what else happened? A few months before she disappeared, Dorothy asked her father if she could move out of the house and get an apartment in Greenwich Village where she could write and be all artistic and stuff.
And someday meet Bob Dylan.
Mm. Yeah. Dad said no.
That was the same time, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Pretty close.
Totally.
It was 20th century.
Yeah, you know.
So, yeah. He said no, and he said something on the order of, a good writer can write anywhere, so you can write in your bedroom, honey.
I feel like that's a great answer, though.
Oh, I know.
I mean...
Okay, we've already gone in the weeds once, but I'm going to stand up for Dad here a little bit.
Yeah.
I already pay for all of this kid's stuff, and I give her an allowance. And by the way, living at home is free, and eating at home is relatively free. But now you want to get an apartment, which means you want me to pay for said apartment and all of your bills.
Well, yeah, and on top of that, you know, I think back in those days that a woman moving out of the house before she actually found a husband and got married,
it was frowned upon.
I was just going to say, at 25 in those days, if you were not actively courting someone suitable to your parents' liking, you were probably not doing super well, according to your parents.
Yeah, she was actually courting somebody. We'll talk about that in a little bit here.
Yeah.
But he was not suitable, unfortunately, to your parents.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, her dad did make a remark along the lines of he wouldn't mind her dating more guys at all, just not worthless guys or something.
No, let's talk about it. Yeah. Let's talk about it. I think we're there.
Yeah, I think we are.
So speaking of that guy, in September 1910, about 3 months before she disappeared, Dorothy told her parents she was going to go visit a former college classmate in Boston. She did go to Boston, but she didn't hang much with her classmate, but she spent the week with a guy named George Griscom Jr.
Griscom.
I think it's Griscom. It might be Grissom or something like that.
I think you got it right.
Let's go for Griscom. Yeah. He was from a rich family in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. They were all proper about it. They stayed in separate hotels, not just separate rooms, but separate hotels.
Mm.
So maybe no copulation occurred. We don't know. But a lot of the Dorothy Arnold theorists out there think that it did, and it forms the basis for a lot of their ideas about why she disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit more about him, George Griscom. She was seeing him, and obviously there was something going on there, but Dorothy's father basically forbade her from seeing him. Because even though he was rich, he came from a good family, he was considered to be, by Dorothy, Mr. Arnold, to be a worthless slacker.
Yeah, I mean, he was like 40-something, 42, right?
Yeah.
And living at home and kind of just like living off of his parents' money.
Yeah,
not
pretty
really.
Much, yeah.
He wasn't earning anything for himself.
Yeah, I had heard that he went to law school and got a law degree and was working as a contract lawyer. For doing contract law, but apparently not working too terribly hard.
Yeah.
And still, you know, if you're 42 and still living at home, you're really not very ambitious, let's face it.
Yeah.
Well, sorry. You're not 42.
That's true.
Yeah. He wasn't out making an name.
I don't
for
even
himself.
Know where that was going.
Yeah.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah. I'm just kidding.
I feel better about my life now.
I just really wanted to stick a finger in your
eye. I'm not
going to
go throw myself off a bridge like Dorothy did. Oh, no, wait. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're getting ahead of her.
Yeah.
You gave away the ending. No, she didn't really throw herself off a bridge.
So George was not a suitable suitor.
Not in the eyes of Dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, the folks didn't actually find out about this Boston thing with Griscom until after the disappearance, when apparently the Boston police discovered that Dorothy had pawned $500 worth of jewelry to pay for her hotel room. And this leads me to observe that if copulation actually had occurred, you would think that Griscom would have paid her hotel bill at least.
As a gentleman.
Don't you think? Wouldn't that be the classy thing to do?
Well, you know, and
he doesn't sound like he had a lot of class. Let's be honest.
Well, he might have been on a short leash, too. Maybe the folks didn't give him a huge allowance.
I think we need to back up here a little bit.
Yeah.
I think we've missed a salient point in this story, which is, so she disappeared.
Uh-huh.
And then now we're talking about like some of the investigation that found Griscom.
Uh-huh.
But I think what's important for people to understand is the cops weren't brought in
until kind of
3 weeks later or four, 2 weeks later.
It varies, you know. Actually,
yeah, it was weeks later because they were keeping it under the rug. They called their lawyer.
They called their lawyer, yeah.
And the lawyer looked for her.
No, yeah. The lawyer didn't. He hired a private investigator. Well, he actually
did a lot of looking too.
But the thing is that I think people understand is this didn't become a full fledged investigation right away.
Although
she disappeared, they didn't say anything because there's that.
They didn't say anything to the cops for a while because you know they probably were thinking that there could be something scandalous here. Like they're going to search for her, and then when she turns up, she's going to be like, you know, shacked up in a hotel room with some dude,
right?
Or something like that,
right?
You know?
But
so
I mean,
they wanted to keep it quiet.
There was all kinds of rumors of weird stuff that they did. Somebody called the house. One of her girlfriends called the house the night she disappeared,
mm-hmm.
and her mother said, "Yeah, she's here. Oh, can I talk to her?" No, she's asleep in bed.
Yeah, she went to bed with a headache or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, which is, I mean, there's a lot of weird things about this story, and I think that it's that natural tendency of people with money to try to hide anything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an important point for people to understand that it wasn't suddenly the police were investigating her disappearance. Mm-hmm. There's a time lag here, which is always a detriment to an investigation.
Yeah, well, hell yeah. But according to some accounts, the time lag was 6 weeks before they talked to the cops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they supposedly hired Pinkerton Detectives.
Pinkerton, which is a fairly famous detective agency, as it turns out.
Yeah, although actually in a newspaper account that I read of it, the newspaper account kind of made it clear that the police had actually been brought in much earlier, like a week after she
disappeared. Really?
Yeah, but he didn't. They didn't actually go public until about 6 weeks after.
Okay. See, when I was the articles I came across insinuated that it had been multiple weeks, but that might be just when it was released.
It's also hard to tell. You know, as again, Steve and I were talking about this earlier, and we were talking about the fact that you know, late 1800s, early 1900s. All of these articles kind of just read like People magazine.
They do.
You know, and it may be, you know, slight differences in the writing styles, things like that. But a lot of it is just kind of, well, we heard from a source that so-and-so knows that so-and-so knows that so-and-so uh-huh. said, blah, 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 blah. You know, it reads like a gossip column kind of more than news is what we're used to.
Yeah,
but
I was going to talk about this in a little bit. This article from the Pittsburgh Press that came out in 1914 that was a big game changer for the whole thing. And it was like, and the article contradicts itself. It's kind of incoherent.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of contradicts itself. But anyway, more on that later. All right, so the Arnold family asked a friend who was also a lawyer, whose name was John Keith, and they hired him to try to find Dorothy. So Keith, Keith was a lawyer and not a private eye, so I suspect that they hired him because of attorney-client privilege.
Mm.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
If they wanted to keep it low.
Yeah, and plus he was a family friend, so he could be expected to keep it on the DL.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and as we said, they didn't want publicity. They reportedly didn't tell the police for 6 weeks, although maybe it was less than that, but the police managed to keep quiet about the whole thing, although that's kind of surprising because the police, even these days, are kind of corrupt in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're known to leak.
Yeah. They're known to, like, you know, sell information to reporters, but that would be a good reason to keep him out. So anyway, John Keith came over to the house and searched her room looking for clues. Apparently all of her stuff was there, her clothes and everything else.
Save for the one outfit she was wearing, right?
Of course, yeah. She had to go out. She couldn't go out naked, for Christ's sake.
Well.
Yeah. Well, she could.
But.
Yeah.
She didn't.
That would be, looked upon with disfavor. But he found some burned papers in the fireplace, which everybody assumed were just the manuscripts that had been rejected by McClure's. Mm. You know, again, come on, Dorothy, you know. Man up. Send it out to somebody else under a phony name.
Send it cracked, man. They'd accept it.
They found brochures, too.
Cracked.
Cracked. Yeah, they probably would.
I'm so sorry, everyone.
What else? One thing that piqued a little interest is they found some brochures, apparently, for steamliners to Europe. Because remember, in those days, they didn't have 777s. You had to actually take a slow boat. And that fueled a lot of speculation then and even today that she wanted to run off and join Griscom or somebody else and just, you know, start a new life.
Mm.
Maybe. So John Keith went checked hospitals, jails, morgues in New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, looking for her body or whatever, and he found nothing. Finally, he suggested hiring the Pinkerton Detective Agency.
Which is still in operation today.
Yeah.
And is a very famous historic investigation service. Just throwing that out there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. No, they've Google Pinkerton,
yeah. Pinkerton investigations, and you will find some stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm expecting them to call us one of these days.
I hope so.
We got a really tough mystery here. We just can't crack it.
Well, since we solve everything.
I know.
They're not going to call us because you know what's going to happen. Is Joe's going to answer the phone. He's going, duh. It was the Chupacabra.
I know.
Dun, dun, dun.
Send me my money and hang up.
Yeah.
Well, that's why we don't give Joe the phone.
I see. I could just picture that, though. Yeah. Get out my magnifying glass. I see it. You see right over here? This track looks like nothing, but it's actually a Chupacabra track. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, enough of that. So anyway, the Pinkertons did more of the same. They searched hospitals, morgues, same thing, you know, except that they were able to cast a wider net since they weren't one single attorney. And after they thought about the tickets and everything, they sent some detectives to Europe to look for her also. And so they spent a lot of money on this.
You know, I gotta raise something. That I was reading the newspaper accounts and the stuff about the Pinkertons. And, of course, they couldn't send somebody to Europe to look for her getting off the boat because they couldn't get there fast enough. So they had to wire her description.
Mm-hmm.
So
I
know what this woman looks like according to a written description. And they find a number of women who they think could look like her, but who say they aren't her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, one, a written description of somebody is very far flung from what they actually look like. And two, if I walk up and I say, excuse me,
are you Dorothy?
And you go, no, dude, no. I'm Jane. I'm from Illinois. Oh, sorry. And this move about your business. How effective of a search means is this?
This is very true. I mean, I don't know. Back in those days, they couldn't exactly email some photos.
That's what I mean, is that they sent people to look for people getting off the boats. It's like, this doesn't seem like it's got a high probability of success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can see that. Europe's kind of a big place.
Man. Looking for people was really hard back in those days.
Looking for people today is hard.
I know, and you can email stuff and like make things viral. And
I lose people in crowds that I know.
Yeah.
Like, where were you? 2 feet in front of you. Really?
I was hiding from you. I was hoping never to see you again.
Obviously.
In plain sight.
Yeah.
So they looked in Europe because of the steamliner brochures, right?
Yeah.
Were there any other reasons that they found to look in New York? In Europe? Yeah.
Well, there was one other guy, yeah. There was George Griscom, who it turns out went to Italy. I'm not sure exactly when he went over there, but he was in Italy with his folks, tootling around.
He was with his parents.
Yeah, they telegraphed him. Apparently, they got a hold of him, and he telegraphed them back and said he didn't know anything about what happened to Dorothy. And they weren't buying it, so apparently Mother Mary and her older brother John went to Naples to confront him.
No, not the mother's older brother, but Dorothy's older brother,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Her son, John. Dorothy's
her son, John.
Brother.
Okay.
Yeah. So he denied it, and he gave them a letter that he'd received from her in December, apparently. Although in some accounts it says that he gave them a sheaf of letters.
Mm. Yeah, like a case of them.
Yeah,
that was what I had read. Yeah,
yeah, or a packet or something like that. But so the letter, this last letter mentioned that she had just gotten, she'd just been rejected by McClure's again, that she was kind of depressed over the whole thing. And that, of course, fueled speculation that she may have committed suicide because she was so down over this whole thing about not getting her stories accepted.
Yeah. And the hard thing with Griscom is I spent a lot of time looking at him, trying to pin down when he went to Italy.
Mm.
Because I thought
that's what I was curious about too.
Yeah, I really was.
Everybody thinks, oh, maybe he murdered her. You know?
Well, yeah, and yeah. So I was like, well, okay, well, when the heck did he leave the country?
I wasn't able to find that.
And
out.
All you can ever find is when he came back.
Yeah, I know.
Nothing says when he left, which either means that A, reporters just didn't think to ask, or B, he just never said how long he'd been on holiday.
Yeah,
I guess I got the sense that he'd been gone for a while, and finding out that he went with his family kind of makes his story less suspicious to me.
Yeah, because it wasn't like he was escaping or escaped the heat or anything like that. Yeah, it also sounds like if he was over there and she was sending him a bunch of letters to the point where he had a whole sheaf of them or a whole packet of them, that he was over there for a while.
Well, and that they had found letters in her possession, right, that had a foreign...
For postmarks.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So they could were corresponding, have been corresponding.
Even though they were forbidden to see each other.
So I would suspect that he had been overseas for a while.
Well, there'd been 3 months between their rendezvous in September, and then when she disappeared in December. That's a three-month time span.
Mm-hmm.
If you write every couple of days... That's going to be a stack of letters after a couple of months.
Yeah, well, I was kind of assuming that he was not hanging on to every letter ever that she wrote, but just the ones that he'd received since he'd arrived in Europe, and maybe the ones while he was in the States were back home in a drawer. Mm. But I assume that the ones in that sheaf were just ones that he'd received in Europe.
Sure, and let's be again, like, let's reiterate the fact that those letters come over on. Ships.
Yeah, they take a while to get there.
It takes a while to get there and back. So if you have a couple, even just like five or six, that represents a couple weeks either way.
Yeah, yeah. And so he probably, that last letter probably got that in, who knows, mid to late December, maybe even January.
Yeah.
And by the way, this confrontation took place in January 1911.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And she disappeared in December.
In December,
it seems unlikely to me that he was in the States at that point, but, you know, who knows?
Okay, so anyway, we're back. We're going to resume the history, just one more little thing, and then we're going to talk about some theories about what happened. So, anyway, at about 6 weeks after the disappearance, the police persuaded Francis Arnold, her dad, to hold a press conference, and he did. And by this time, he had been convinced that she was dead. And so he said at the press conference that he thought that she'd been murdered in Central Park and thrown into the reservoir. And so everybody in town started drinking bottled water.
Just like in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. And then, but there was one problem with that theory, which is the police pointed out to him that it was, the temperature was like 22 degrees or 21 degrees on the day that she disappeared. So, and the lake was frozen over and people had been skating on it. So I'm not sure why he was so convinced that she had been murdered and much less thrown in the lake.
He was so convinced that she was dead that in his will, like,
she wasn't mentioned
later.
Yeah.
No, she was mentioned specifically that he left no provisions for her because he had been sufficiently convinced that she was dead.
Yeah.
Mm.
He said, in fact, I am intentionally not leaving anything for her because in my mind, she's dead.
Yeah. She appeared.
Which is like a step extra, right?
Yeah.
It's not only saying like, well, my daughter's dead, so I'm just not going to mention her. It's saying, no, I'm going to take the time out in my will to say,
Yeah.
Oh, no, she's absolutely dead.
Yeah.
So that to me is a little hinky.
Well, and we're about to get into theories, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let me just throw out this random one.
Yeah.
And this is fueled by my extensive knowledge of New York socialite behavior from watching Castle, is that they do all kinds of weird things to protect the family name. So if he is so convinced that she's dead, how do we know he didn't have her knocked?
Well, we don't.
Yeah,
because if he's like, oh, I'm just going to make a provision. She was thrown into the reservoir. That's because that's what the guy that I hired her to knock her off for whatever offense he deemed so terrible to get rid of her for, had said he had done.
And then the guy goes to throw her in, and it's frozen over. So,
and she skips.
Joke's on you.
And then he drags her somewhere else. But I would, it's plausible.
Well,
if this guy was from the start, he was dang near from the start. It sounded like he was convinced she was dead.
Well, not from the start. I mean, I think as time went by, he just became convinced that she was dead for God knows what reason. Probably,
but and again, this is the newspaper recounts, which makes it difficult. But he seemed to be one of the first ones that I noticed saying, "I'm pretty sure she's dead."
Yeah,
Now, maybe that's him being practical and, you know, detaching himself from the situation because his daughter is missing and he's got no other choice but to presume she's dead. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's, well, I sort of know and let me just lean towards this theory and see if anybody else follows me with it.
Yeah. Well, this guy knew his daughter pretty well, probably. I mean, most people know their family members really well. So the options, like, she just left, just for whatever reason, just ran away from home. You know, he may have known her well enough to know that that could never happen. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, like, look at her behavior regarding her literary rejections. Mm-hmm. She didn't have a lot of stick-to-itiveness. I mean, he maybe understood that she didn't have, what's the word that I'm thinking about here?
Resilience? Chutzpah.
The resilience, the chutzpah, to actually go out and make a life of her own. He probably figured that if she did run away from home, she would have been back in two weeks.
Yeah, right? She would be like me running away from home and making it halfway across the block and sitting there being like, why aren't they coming after
me? Yeah.
This is such a long walk.
I know.
I'm tired. I'm hungry.
She could have. There were some theories that she'd like, you know, had an accident and had amnesia and she was in a hospital somewhere, you know, but obviously they'd searched all that. So that possibility was ruled out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so there's not that many possibilities in his mind, probably. It's like she hasn't come back, and I know she would be back by now if she was still alive and it didn't have amnesia, so she's got to be dead. And she didn't just up and die because she was in good health, so that means, you know, New York, it was a dangerous place back in those days. It's very possible somebody, but anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yes, we are.
Okay, let's talk about theories. There's a lot of stuff out there. There's actually still, even today, many years later, there's still people talking about this. God, I went to, there's a website called Web Sleuths. Have you seen those guys?
We've seen those guys.
we know those guys pretty well.
I almost made it to an entire thread, and it went on for years. I mean, it was a long thread. And boy, I mean, I found a few useful little nuggets in there, but holy crap, I had to wade through just a ton of bills.
That's why. I think that's why Steve and I just don't do that anymore.
I will read about the first dozen and then I quit.
Yeah.
If I can find a link to like three good things in a row, I will link it and we'll read it. But pretty much other than that, I just can't.
Yeah, it's
well,
just bad.
It's the issue with all forums. But we've gone into that before. So.
Oh yeah. But anyway, yeah, there's a lot of theorizing on those, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. But. And actually, as this thread went on that I was reading through, it's like the one theory that came out, seemed to come out on top, that more and more of them seemed to believe in was our theory number one, which is that Dorothy ran away to join the circus.
Okay, but not the circus, but ran away.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly.
That's the Joe interpretation.
To the point where all these people are, you know, lots and lots of these people are saying, I hope she just really had a wonderful life, you know, and yada, yada. And it's like, dudes, really? You know, I mean, and it's kind of a group thing kind of thing, because there were other theories that were kind of prevalent, and then more and more of them seemed to trend to this whole that she ran away to get away from her domineering father.
So what is this theory?
Yeah, and so in this interpretation, she was chafing at her domineering father, although it's not necessarily clear that he was domineering. I mean, there's stuff like on her Wikipedia page, and there was a lot of this on this particular Web Sleuths thread, that her family was just, they were completely mean to her. They tormented her.
That was the whole thing about finding out about her writing.
Yeah,
and just
staring at her and mocking at her. But there's not much evidence in that. I mean, this stuff kind of, like, it got to the point where in this thread, for example, it built to this point where they're saying, you know, it started out with, oh, they're teasing her, they're mocking her. And then it got to the point where they were so vicious towards her. I don't blame her for leaving. You know, I mean, they're all just, they just convince themselves of this stuff.
Well, and the only bit of evidence that really I've seen in researching this was that she stopped getting mail for her writing at the house. She got a P.O. box.
Yeah.
So that the family didn't see those letters come through.
Yeah.
Okay, well, if she had one rejection, and then she got a P.O. box because they teased her, and she got a second rejection. Okay, well, that just makes sense. You know, my family doesn't need to know what I'm doing.
Well, exactly.
They can be jerks because they're family.
That's the whole thing, is you're 25 years old, you're living at home, but you don't want your parents and your family to be in all your stuff, right? You know, so that doesn't necessarily mean her family was being nasty to her.
Yeah, that whole theory really like screams to me the kind of demographic that comments on threads like this very often, right? And I am not so far out of this demographic of the like kind of like mid to late teens, early 20s demographic, where it's very easy to like play the victim and like identify with that person who's like being victimized and like, oh man, her life was so hard. Mm-hmm. It's like you forget that, oh my gosh, she was being given like $2,400 a month just for existing.
I know.
You know, like she was living a totally pampered life.
Yeah,
maybe like her family was tormenting her, but probably not tormenting her, probably just like every family does, where you're just like, oh, yeah. the writer over there, the artist over there, which my family does all the time. Everybody's family does. That's part of a healthy family dynamic.
Yeah, sure.
But when you're in your like mid to late teens, early 20s, you see that as like, oh, my family hates me. Like, my life is so hard.
Yeah.
And I think with stories like this, it's really easy to grab onto that one little tiny nugget of like the way that family life could be. And ignore everything else and say, well, she was tormented. Thank God she left.
No, and exactly. Like, this is a thread. They're reading each other's postings, you know, and so it's sort of like a rumor, you know. It just gets out of one person reads this and somebody adds just a little
it's
bit
chain
to
mail,
it. And,
right?
Yeah, it's chain mail.
Today's chain mail.
Yeah, so anyway, so there's some theories that people have out there that she left to start a life of her own. And other people say that she left to run off with George Griscom or somebody else and start a new life. But on the flip side, as you were saying, she had a pampered life. Everything was taken care of, and she had that big fat allowance. And she didn't have to spend that if she wanted to buy stuff. She could put things on the family account.
Yeah.
And as we discussed earlier, she wasn't really like a stick-to-her-guns kind of lady.
No, exactly.
You know, Plus, she would have gotten into it and realized it was hard and probably come back and said, oops, just kidding.
Yeah, and even, you know, I think that even if she'd left and actually made a good life for herself, unless there was some hideous abuse that I'm not aware of, I think sooner or later she would have contacted her family.
I agree.
You know, I mean, So that's why I think this is just pure BS.
I agree.
Yeah. All right. The next theory, botched abortion, part one.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay.
Part one?
Botched abortion. 12, I guess.
Yeah. All right. So the Pittsburgh Press published an article on April 10th, 1914.
This is the like kind of coherent one we were talking about, right?
The semi-coherent one, the one that contradicts itself just a little bit.
Okay. Yeah.
Because of this article, a lot of people are out there theorizing that Dorothy went to an abortion clinic in Pittsburgh and died there due to a botched abortion. A lot of people make a lot about the location, which is in Pittsburgh. That's where Griscom lived at the time. His family
but he
was
wasn't
from Pittsburgh.
There.
Yeah, and but the fact is I don't know if he was there or not.
No, he wouldn't have been if he received.
He should have been. He should have been in Europe at this time.
Well, but if
not
he received
certain.
A letter in December, anytime in December, really. Mm.
Yeah.
In Italy, it would have had to have been sent early December.
It seems that he could not have been there, yes.
Wait. We're making a presumption here that he kept the letter in the envelope that it arrived in to prove that he was there.
I got to be honest with you. I think that people were suspicious enough of him that had he been lacking the envelope or been able to otherwise not able to prove that...
Well, he's a pretty rich dude. I think he could have persuaded people to not be looking for... Listen,
I'm not sure.
I opened the letter and I threw the envelope into the fire
because
I just needed to get the fire going.
Well, I don't know exactly what kind of stationery she used, but back in those days, I mean, I have, after my parents died, I inherited a lot of the family archives.
Mm-hmm.
And from those days, back in the old days... stuff that went across the ocean was generally, they had this, it was like this blue paper where the paper of the letter itself folded up and made the envelope.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's to save weight and save postage.
Oh,
and so,
yeah.
Of course, Dorothy didn't necessarily need to do that. She was rich. So
right.
Maybe she could actually have a letter in an envelope. But back in the old days, I can show you some of those things. It just sort of really super thin paper and it all folded together neatly and made the envelope and the letter was the envelope.
Mm.
And so it might have been that.
Yeah,
it's true. A lot of people keep envelopes. You know, you read the letter, and then you stick the letter back in the envelope, mm-hmm. and you put it in your box.
No, I'm guilty of that, I admit.
Yeah.
I have lots of bills that are still in their envelopes.
Yeah, but anyway, but you know, I'm not saying, I personally don't believe that there's anything to make of the location in Pittsburgh, but a lot of people think, whoa,
And what's the basis behind this again?
Yeah.
The Pittsburgh
thing?
Is because that's where Grissom lived?
Yeah, that's where his family was okay. from. Okay. Yeah. So the basis of this whole abortion thing is that a lot of people theorize that during their week together in Boston, he got her pregnant.
Mm.
Yeah, and she needed to get an abortion. Remember, that was in September, so she's like, you know...
A couple months along.
Yeah, yeah. And
3 months
along. She's... Yeah.
2 to 3 months, somewhere in that ballpark.
I guess 3 is about when you know.
Yeah. You missed a few periods, you know.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, you miss one. Okay, like, fine, whatever. I'm stressed. I'm depressed. You
I've
miss two.
I've been eating Cheetos for the last 3 weeks. But
yeah. Yeah, or I'm anorexic, but yeah.
Sabor de Soledad's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, I guess 2, you probably make the appointment. 3, you go to the appointment. I don't know.
No. I don't think, yeah, I can't say.
Yeah. Well, so
no,
anyway.
You can't.
I have no idea.
Nope.
Yeah. So the article included testimony from a local doctor. His name was Lutz, and he said that one of his female patients, Lutz, why is that making you laugh?
Because I just made a 30 Rock reference, and now we're making another one inadvertently.
Oh,
I apologize.
Totally inadvertent. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
All right. What does Dr. Lutz say?
Well, the Dr. Lutz apparently told the local DA, and this appeared in the paper, that one of his female patients had been to this abortion clinic, and in other parts of the paper actually has 2 articles about this in the same day. In the other article, they call it a sanitarium. This one, they call it, like, you know, a clinic or whatever.
Like,
where women
I feel
were
like
operated
that was a fairly
on.
Interchangeable term in those
yeah,
days.
Yeah, I know. Sanitarium doesn't necessarily mean what it means today
no.
in those days. Well, anyway, so he said that one of his female patients told him that she had been up there and that she had seen Dorothy Arnold at this clinic, at this abortion clinic.
Hmm.
Yeah, and so... Well,
and,
also,
and this is years after
this
the
is
fact.
This is 3 years after.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is 3 years after. Oh, excuse me. It's about three years.
A little over 3 years
after. But at the same time, this newspaper article, and let's not underestimate the ability of the press to misquote and distort things.
Yeah.
But just another paragraph down, they do the whole woman patient of Dr. Lutz says that she saw, but then a paragraph down, they say the source of Dr. Lutz's allegation is that the doctor himself, the abortionist who ran the clinic, told him.
Well, and then don't they later say that, actually the tip was from the assistant, the abortionist's assistant,
no. Well,
Lucy?
But that actually goes back 3 years. I'll explain that in a second.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'll actually explain that.
I'm confused, obviously.
Yeah, I know. No, it is confusing. If you read about this, it says that John Keith went and investigated a sanitarium in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Right, that's right.
Where she
okay.
was reported to be.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like 400 miles away.
Yeah, 375 miles, yeah.
That's a long way to go.
Yeah.
That's a long walk in a day.
Yeah. To me, if the clinic's owner, the abortionist, whose name was C.C. Meredith, if he had actually had Dorothy there and killed her in an abortion...
By botching it.
It seems a little hard for me to believe that he would tell somebody else that she was there.
Yeah.
Because that's an illegal operation to start with,
well,
let alone just talking about it.
Well, yeah, because...
Killing somebody.
Yeah, and it's not just... You're not just going to be... If you kill somebody, you're not just going to be tried for illegal abortions. You're going to be tried for murder.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so it's something you're going to keep your mouth shut about.
Murder and then all of the, like... hundreds of illegal abortions you've performed.
Yeah,
which I think at that point also account to murder.
Yeah, yeah, probably, or at least manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly about this particular little place, this clinic, is that John Keith had been there 3 years before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
the lawyer.
That's where
John
I'm
Keith,
a
the
little,
lawyer.
Right.
He had been there.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
That's what, in this Philadelphia Press article, the main article is about the fact that the local police had raided this place, and there was a clue
and
from this doctor.
Out.
Yeah, they raided this place, and they busted them and all that stuff. And they had this our whole thing, that the Dorothy Arnold connection from this Dr. Lutz, who had heard from apparently 2 different sources but there's a second article where they talked with John Keith about his visit 3 years prior to the same place.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's what you're talking about, where he got a tip
from
somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
So somebody in the clinic, apparently, contacted a lawyer who contacted Keith. And she said that she was in a sanitarium in some accounts, or that she was you know, in this place. And it's that the story is confused because
like alive in this place,
like alive in this place.
And okay,
she said that somebody was in their sanitarium who claimed to be Dorothy Arnold. And you'll find this in some of the accounts that are out there on the web, and they make it look like it's a separate place, mm-hmm. but it's the same place, interestingly enough. So anyway, John Keith had been there. Apparently, he'd received a tip from a lawyer in Pittsburgh,
right?
Who was informed by a person in this quote unquote sanitarium. Whose name turned out to be Orr, O-R-R. And so he came right straight away to investigate this. And when he came in there, he actually had to coerce Dr. Meredith, the abortionist who owned the place. He actually had to coerce him a bit into letting him in to see him. Basically, he threatened to show up with the chief of police and a whole bunch of reporters if he didn't get a private tour. And so Dr. Meredith was like, oh, okay, I'll give you a tour.
Mm-hmm.
And
private
so he
tour.
Shows up, walks in the door, and spots nurse Lucy Orr. Lucy Orr was one of the people who's mentioned in this September 14th article about the raid.
Mm.
So, he explicitly said in this article, said her name. So, he said, are you the person who knows about Dorothy Arnold? And she says, yes. And he says, where is she? And she points to this room. So he goes into the room and looks at this woman that's in there and says, and comes back out and says, that's not her. So did she actually tell you? Because she had said that this woman was saying she was Dorothy Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, did she really tell you that? And this woman said, well, no, she didn't actually tell me that, but I didn't think you'd come otherwise. But I think she looks just like Dorothy Arnold.
Yeah.
And so he went all the way out there. That was 3 years before
really?
This big bust. Yeah. But, okay.
So why is this not a good theory?
Because it was a terrible lead.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
That one.
Well, first of all, the reason this is a ludicrous theory is Pittsburgh is 375 miles away from Manhattan. So you're not gonna cover that kind of ground in a quick afternoon.
You're not gonna say I went shopping.
Yeah, hell okay. no. Okay.
Fair.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. There are some people who have said that they believe that the Arnold family knew that she was with child and needed to go get it taken care of, and they sent her away to go get it taken care of. So they knew she was in Pittsburgh.
What?
But then why would they be calling all of her friends that night when she doesn't come back?
Also, why would they send her to Pittsburgh?
Yeah.
It's New York. Surely there's a reputable abortionist there.
I'm sure there were plenty of unreputable people doing that kind of work.
Oh, sure. Yeah. But I'm sure that, like, you know, as reputable as the people in Pittsburgh are, you could find in New York easily.
Yeah.
New York. It's a big city.
That's one of the reasons that a lot of people like this whole theory, though, is that because Griscom lived there and he was supposedly a wealthy playboy, then he knew a good place to go. You know, so that's fueled that.
Mm.
Okay, the next reason why this is BS. And this kind of, like, is tough on the next one, too. But the letter. The letter that, or letters... that George Griscom actually handed over to the family from when he was in Europe. So she would, if she was knocked up, she would be talking about that in those letters. Do you think he wants to open that can of worms with her family?
But here's what I will say, is that I'm not sure if she would talk about that if she were just going to get it taken care of.
Yeah, you think she didn't say anything to him?
As a young woman
there would be a discussion back and forth.
I don't know if that's true. If she had just decided, nope, this isn't the right time for me. My parents are not going to allow me to marry this man. I clearly cannot have this baby. If she had just made that choice on her own and gone and solicited some kind of shady abortion, back alley abortion, this opens a can of worms. Ideally, there would have been a conversation.
Yeah.
But is there always? No.
Well, maybe not. But I think there probably would have been, which is why I kind of felt like, you know, he probably,
but
you're right. I mean, maybe there was no mention. Next reason, the tip that John Keith received from the attorney that was received from Lucy Orr, the abortionist assistant. So that absolutely makes no sense, because if Dorothy Arnold had come there, been killed through a botched abortion, and the body is disposed of. Oh, by the way, did I mention they have huge furnaces in the bottom of this house where they supposedly burn the bodies of the women who died? Yeah. Are you going to actually find a way to get a friend and lawyer for the family out to your clinic to look around?
I mean,
that is absolutely absurd.
Unless she died much later from unknown complications.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe.
But again, I'm on your side with this one.
Yeah, that one's completely ludicrous. Anyway, our next theory, botched abortion part two. So in this one, a convicted fellow named Edward Glenoris.
This is actually the most colorful story involved or theory in this entire thing.
Yeah.
He said that he was in prison at the time, but he said that he was paid $250 to bury the body of a young woman in December 1910. He said that an acquaintance hired him to drive a woman from a home in New Rochelle. New Rochelle is about 15 miles northwest of Dorothy's home. It's on Long Island Sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to drive her from New Rochelle to Weehawken, New Jersey. Not exactly why. So they arrive at New Rochelle, and Edward Glenoris and the guy that hired him, whose name is Little Louie, were met by two men, and one was named Doc.
Such a New York name.
I know.
Little Louie.
Hey, Little Louie.
Hey, Little Louie.
So they were met by two men, one named Doc and another that he described as a, quote, wealthy, well-dressed man, unquote, who reportedly matched George Griscom's description. And, you know, I'm not buying any of this, but we'll talk about that later. So they loaded this unconscious woman into the car, drove her to a house in Weehawken, New Jersey, and then Little Louie told Glenoris during the drive that the woman was Dorothy Arnold. Glenoris said he recognized her, and then the next day Little Louie contacted him again to, quote-unquote, finish the job. So they went back to Weehawken. Doc told the men that the woman had died at that home in Weehawken during an operation. So Little Louie and Glenoris drove the woman's body back to the home in New Rochelle, wrapped her body in a sheet, buried her in the cellar.
Wait, I thought they buried her in a cellar in West Point.
Accounts vary.
Okay,
This is the internet, that's why
I'm asking, because I know this is one of those things where it gets kind of muddy in the tellings.
Yep, I know. They actually dug up cellars and homes in the area, but couldn't find any human remains. So anyway, why is this BS? Okay, number one, I don't think she was pregnant to begin with. I mean, but number two, I mean, she might have been, but New Rochelle is about 15 miles northeast of the family home. She could have jetted up there, left the home. Hey, I'm going to go shopping, jet up to New Rochelle, get your abortion, get back. But instead, she walked the other direction. She walked south.
And got chocolate, right?
And got chocolate and bought a book and hung out. So obviously...
But why couldn't she have gotten a ride after that point?
She could have, but the thing about it is you're kind of pushing it. You got to be home by dinner time. And the last time you're seen is when you run into your friend outside the bookstore at 2 p.m.
Yeah.
So it's like...
That is pushing it.
And don't forget, I mean, they didn't have much in the way of transportation in these days. Cars were a really new thing.
Oh, yeah, they were slow and terrible. Yeah, they were like, 5 miles an hour?
Well, probably a little better than that. But she probably would have taken a horse and buggy at this time. But and so 15 miles in a horse and buggy, that's a little bit of time compared to jumping in your car today.
I can just see, though, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but she says, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to go, and... She's got a terrible sense of time. I mean, we all know those friends who say, it'll only take me this much time to do this. So I'm going to do these other things in the morning, and I'll be at your place by 11 o'clock. And then they show up at 3 in the afternoon because they have no sense of time and they cannot judge how long things take. Mm-hmm. So she might have thought, well, I'll go get a book so that I have something to read on the way there and the way back. And it'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And if I'm late, well, I'll just say that I'm ill and I had to stop because I didn't feel good.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm obviously, this is conjecture.
Yeah.
But I'm just looking at it as, well, maybe... This could be the thought process that was involved if she really was pregnant, which, again, I'm not positive she was.
Yeah,
but
not at all.
I'm just saying if this is a possibility, and that seems – I know tons of people who do that crap all the time.
But, I know people like that too, but this is a pretty important thing. This is a big deal. You know, you're knocked up, and this is your salvation. You're going to go get this abortion and everything. It's going to save you from being publicly humiliated and cast out by your family. Pretty huge deal. That's something I'm sure she would try to be on time for. I don't think she'd screw around for hours walking around Manhattan buying chocolate and books. Don't you think? What do you think?
Well, she might have been making a day of it.
Yeah.
Not to be aloof about what she was doing, but she might have said, well, I'm going to do these things, so at least I do these things, and then I will go take care of that.
Or trying to cover her tracks.
Yeah.
Knowing, okay, so here are the two places, or, you know, two best places that I have family accounts,
uh-huh,
at, right?
Yeah.
That aren't near this clinic that I'm going to. so it doesn't look like I'm going to this clinic or this house or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have an account at this chocolate place that's a couple miles away, and then I can go buy a book and, oh, I ran into a friend. How convenient. Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, or swing around the
panic,
corner, catch
oh, God,
a cab.
Oh, God, I ran into a friend.
Yeah, I mean, you know, either way.
Catch a cab. Oh, look, let's remember, this is horse and buggy days. So
okay.
A horse and buggy goes, what, 5-6 miles an hour?
Is it? Is it horse and buggy days?
They were,
the
they
car
were,
was not very
the car
very big.
Was, yeah, the car, they were actually people. Actually, believe it or not, Henry Ford was not making Model Ts at this time yet. The first thing that came out
they
of was kind of mass-produced was Oldsmobile was actually producing cars, but not huge numbers.
Mm-hmm.
There just weren't, and there were a lot of small manufacturers making weird, claptrappy kind of not.
Yeah, everybody
stuff.
Was making their own car.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But no, mostly it was horse and buggy. And so you have to expect that if she had caught a horse and buggy, she had to go all the way to New Rochelle from her place, which is now, after all her miles of walking, now in Lower Manhattan, she had actually added miles to her journey to New Rochelle by walking in the direction that she did. It's going to take quite a while to get there.
True.
And then I don't know how long abortions. It's been so long since I've had an abortion, I can't remember how long it took.
That was terrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrible.
I guess I just kept thinking cars because it sounded like, gosh, the felon.
Yeah, he said they were supposed to drive her.
Yeah.
But driving back in those days, it means driving in a buggy or in a wagon.
I guess
or something
Model
like
Ts were like the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe? Okay. All right. I guess I just have this.
Yeah.
Old view of or new view of what cars are. What are the other non-abortion theories?
Let's get into a different theory. Okay, another theory is suicide.
She was
depressed.
Oh,
another
we just went
beautiful
from
theory.
Depressing to more depressing. Thank you,
well,
Joe.
Yeah, you know that's the thing about it is I think one reason that so many people are in love with the whole idea that she ran away to start a new
life.
Because
that's somehow the nicest theory.
Yeah, everything else is kind of horrible.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, seriously.
Yeah, because the last 20-25 minutes have just been joy.
I know. Yes.
Some more joy.
Obviously, if I could choose a fate for Dorothy, I would have her run away and have a happy life somewhere else, you know. But I don't think it worked out that way, personally.
Well, okay. What is this theory?
People believe, you know, based on the fact that she'd been rejected, and of course, what was said in a letter to George Griscom about how she was kind of down and dejected her essays had been rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And even John Keith, the attorney, said years afterwards that he believed that she committed suicide because of her literary failures and because she felt so, you know,
because
sad.
Because she got rejection from two different.
Yeah, she got. But, you know, I think it's this is possible, but I don't think it's necessarily true because, number one, the body was never found, which is still possible. I mean, she could have jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge and her body drifted out to sea and was never seen again.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Possible.
Although, of course, there was lots of foot traffic on the and horse and buggy traffic on the Brooklyn Bridge in those days, so she probably wouldn't have been able to jump off that bridge or any other bridge without being
certainly
noticed.
Not at midday.
No,
kind of,
or or mid-afternoon. And the other thing is that not the people who saw her, like, were, of course, her family saw her before she left, and her friend Gladys King saw her. None of them noticed anything unusual or depressive about her.
That seems to be the sort of thing that is really, really open to suggestion, right? If somebody says, oh, well, maybe she jumped off a bridge, they'll be like, oh, she did seem a little depressed.
Yeah.
If she even seemed like the teensiest bit depressed,
yeah.
Although, you know, again, on the other hand, people who are about to do things like that, oftentimes you kind of hear descriptions of them as being like really liberated
euphoric.
And free and euphoric.
Yeah, maybe she felt like she'd made this decision and like that.
So,
but my theory is that maybe she was depressed, but she was shopping and she's, you know, that just made her happy.
Yeah.
She was a shopaholic.
Alternately, she was shopping and couldn't find the right size, and it made her even more depressed.
Yeah, that's probably what it is. She found this beautiful smock.
God, we are just going downhill, you two.
Yeah.
This is spiraling out of control.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yo, come on, what's the next theory? Because it's got to be better than these
next
two.
Next theory, okay, so she was abducted,
no.
robbed, and murdered.
No.
Yeah. Yeah,
Joe, you are no longer allowed to pick your own stories.
We'll do them for
Depressed
you.
Depressed fest.
I mean, I don't like this theory either, but it's plausible. And actually, I find it most plausible at all because I managed to stumble across some crime stats from the New York City Police Department.
From those years?
From 1910, yeah. I just lucked upon it. And according to them, in the boroughs of Manhattan, the Bronx, and Richmond, which is what we now call Staten Island, thousands of people, I can't remember the number, it added up to like 4,000 or 5,000 people, were reported missing just in 1910 alone. And of these, 309 men, 216 women were never heard from again. So that's 525 people that disappeared permanently. And so some of them, I'm sure, ran off to join the circus or whatever.
Or, you know, left the area and just said sayonara to everybody they knew.
Yeah.
There was no reason to maintain ties.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'm sure plenty of those people lived. But a substantial chunk wound up in shallow graves and at the bottom of the river. And that's what I think. And I'm
trying to remember, and guys, help me out and correct me if I'm wrong, weren't opium dens kind of a thing at that time frame, or is that earlier in history?
I mean, I can guess it was like the 1870s and 80s, maybe kind of the 90s.
Segwaying into the 20th century.
Well, yeah, and you know, because, I thought it was later.
Well, there's a lot of drugs these days that this is just a weird cyclical thing of they're popular and everybody does them and then they fall out of fashion and then they start coming back. Maybe they're not as big, but you know, it's there's a lot of stuff that you hear about in the news that drugs that do that.
I gotta say,
it's everything.
Yeah, I gotta say though, you know, when drugs fall out of fashion, that doesn't mean everybody stops doing it.
Right.
I mean, cocaine, for example, is not nearly as big as it used to be, but it's still used.
But I just wonder, is it, you know, opium dens were a thing where it was known. Or heroin, for example. They would know, they'd go to this place and they would do it and they would stay there while they were, quote unquote, experiencing their high and then they leave. But occasionally they'd just OD and they wouldn't wake back up. And who's to say that this girl didn't have something, some kind of habit like that, because she's got the money for it.
Yeah.
So she goes out on a quote unquote shopping trip. And this time she didn't go charge anything to the family because she didn't find anything that day. But she went to that place and she hung out all day, came home. And no tally.
So
she did not. But then she comes home and she does what she does. But one day she just doesn't come home from it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that this girl had a drug habit, but I'm just looking at, well, if we're going to say that, you know, it's suicide or death by some other means, well, it's possible that OD, because that's the kind of thing that happened at that time as well.
Well, you know, other things that happened at that time, right, is like the kidnapping of white women to sell into slavery or prostitution.
Oh, white slavery.
I mean, you know, across the country. I mean, that's the thing that still happens today, but, you know, that certainly
concubine
happened. I mean,
for
you know,
the Shah of Persia.
Well, and let's be honest, like, Oregon has the Shanghai tunnels. Like, those are like later than that time period. It's happened for so long in our history that, like, who knows? I mean, there's so many different options that could have happened to this woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm gonna say one thing against the opium / heroin theory is that she was well known around town, and so she had to really seriously worry about getting found and busted. I mean, maybe she had a habit. And I hate to put
this out there. How many Hollywood stars do we discover had a problem for years?
Yeah, I just don't think she would have gone to an opium den. She might have had a connection somewhere. But I hate to talk about this more because I don't want to drag.
The den is the general term. Yeah, but I'm not saying you're wrong and I'm right.
Yeah,
but.
Oh, no. I hate to, because so many of these series kind of drag her name through the mud. Oh,
that's not what we're trying to do.
An abortion. Oh, yeah, she was a heroin addict and all that stuff. But it's a possibility. I mean, I think the simplest, easiest thing, though, really, is just that there was a lot of street crime. Somebody just knocked her on the head, robbed her, possibly raped her, and then murdered her. It could have been one of those dealios where she's like, "Do you know who I am?" And they go, "No." And she says, "I'm a wealthy socialite. I'm famous around town." And then suddenly the guy's like, "Oh, crap. I was just going to rob you and rape you, and now I got to kill you because, I mean, they're going to take this stuff seriously." And so it could have been something like that, too.
Yeah.
But who the hell knows? I mean, I personally hope she ran off to join the circus and had a happy life.
I really do. I really hope that she had a happy life with the dancing bear.
Yeah.
And that's all there was to
it. Became Big Bertha. And
right. The bearded lady.
Yeah. I sincerely hope so, too, because, like, what other option?
Because some of these things are really
This has got to be one of the most depressing
shows we've ever done. And I am not letting him pick his own stories anymore.
No more.
From now on, you have to run them by us.
Yeah. I did run it by you, as I recall.
In about all of 2 seconds. Oh, it's this, and she disappeared. Oh, okay, that's fine.
No, we're not running by. We're just selecting.
We're vetting
him.
I forget it was. I had her and some other disappearing person. It's like, some other person who mysteriously died. And so, well, which one sounds more interesting to you? And so, go with Dorothy.
Suddenly it's my
fault. Well, truly, I just wish she ended up in Oz.
Toto. It's spelled Toto, but she always pronounces it Toto.
Toto.
That's another reason I hate that movie.
Yeah.
She mispronounces the dog's name.
Here we are.
Yeah. So anyway, so favorite theories, anybody?
The circus.
The circus?
I hope it's the circus.
I want it to be the circus at this point.
I think that it's, you know, it seems like there's so many different things that really could have happened to her.
I mean, it's really no use. I mean, I personally think that the odds are that it was random street crime.
Yeah. And the only reason that this makes this like a high profile unsolved mystery, right, is that she was like a socialite.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She was. You know, like this happens all the time. Yeah, it did. Well, apparently, from all the disappearing people in New York in that year,
all the time,
lots and lots of it going on.
And we're talking about this one because she was rich.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, anyway, sad story. But anyway, I will say for the record that I'm pretty convinced that there was no botched abortion. I don't think it was that. I mean, I think it's pretty convincing. I don't think she was pregnant. So at least we're not dragging her through the mud, right? Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
All right. So anyway, sayonara, Dorothy. That ends our mystery. Another successful mystery solved and all kinds of...
Just so the listeners know, Steve and I are both giving him the, what?
Please finish this story.
All right.
It's sad and I'm going to cry. Yeah,
it was a pathetic, sad story.
I haven't cried like this since Pocahontas.
Yeah. You're probably wondering where you can find our fabulous stuff and download it. Although that's kind of stupid because you've already done it. But you can find us on iTunes and you can download our stuff off of our website also, thinkingsidewayspodcast.com. You can send us an email at thinkingsidewayspodcast@gmail.com. You can also, if you don't have time to download us and put us on your iPod, you can stream us directly using Stitcher. All right, and you can find us and, of course, like us. Like the hell out of us on Facebook. All right, now it's time for your favorite part of the episode, which is listener email. So today we've got an email from Crary. I won't tell you his last name. And Crary, as you know, most of our emails are from people who talk about how they adore us and they wish they were us and stuff like this. But, yeah, Crary is not. I'm not going to call his email negative, but it's a slightly critical one.
It's an honest conversation.
It's a thoughtful, good email, and I'm glad that Crary wrote to us to tell us his concerns. So going back to the Montauk episode, the Montauk Project, let me quote from Crary's email. In the discussion of the, quote, going back in time to write the Civil War nonsense, someone, I think it was Joe, and I think I remember saying this.
It was you. Yeah, I checked it.
Yeah, mentioned that slavery would have given way to industrialization. I apologize and this is still Crary talking, as one should never argue counterfactuals, but it's a subject a bit near to my heart. I'm going to skip a little bit here. However, I think such hand-waving of slavery as an historical force simply doesn't stand up to scrutiny. And I apologize, too, but it's kind of a long email, so I'm not going to read everything word for word. Back to your email, Crary. While the institution of slavery may well have evanesced in the face of the modern capitalist state, we should remember that there were some in the South who opposed this very ideal of the modern economy. And that's very true. This is me again, not Crary talking. In America and in Europe, there were lots of people who were very opposed to the factory system and to capitalism, and a lot of those people are still with us today.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't an inevitability, and so Crary is quite correct in saying that. So let me skip ahead. And also, this is back to Crary, also, even if slavery were to go, this does not mean the legacy would. We still live with the legacy today in this country. And he goes on a little bit, and I'm not going to quote any more of it. Not that your email is not worth quoting in its entirety, because it's a very good, thoughtful email.
It's a very good, lengthy email.
Yeah, and it
I
is.
I think that's the hard part, is it's a very lengthy email. It has a lot of good historical points.
It makes some very good points. Yeah,
but no, I think you're right. It's a good email.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's great, actually. And I thank you for bringing it up, because I think that Crary, if he saw this, what I said that way, then probably some other people did. So I really thank you for bringing it up and giving me the chance to talk about what I really meant. I think what I said was capitalism was eventually going to wipe out slavery.
Industrialization
mm-hmm. would yes. wipe out slavery, which I think it would have. That's not the same as saying that I think that whether the South versus the North wins is six of one, half a dozen of the other. I didn't mean that at all. And obviously, it's a good thing that the North won. If you're a slave, you know, and the question of whether you're set free today versus 50 years from now, well, that's pretty huge.
And
that's the same. Another reason I sort of said what I said is that I don't think that post-Civil War things really improved that much for black folks in America. It really took a long time.
Yeah.
We're still working on it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well,
and
yeah.
We're with still the whole crawling Jim Crow out of that. Thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was segregation and Jim Crow, yeah. I mean, and lynchings and mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, I mean, a hell of a lot of the slaves wound up going back and working on the same plantations they'd been slaves on, except mm-hmm. as sharecroppers. Mm-hmm. So they're still technically free. They were better off. But anyway, I'm not saying six of one, half a dozen of the other. It's a great thing that the North won. And like I said, Crary, thanks a lot for the email. I appreciate the mention of all this stuff.
Yeah, this is something that we don't really realize, you know, because we all have known each other long enough to that, like, we know what we mean.
Oh, I totally get
things like this. Yeah. You know, when Joe says something like that, we're like, oh, yeah, totally. We totally get what you mean. Yeah. And then we realize,
So
not everybody knows that.
Yeah, now for all our listeners, too, feel free to write emails like this. Don't feel like you need to just write in and send us love letters. I mean, you can be critical. you can tell us how much we disgust you.
We have gotten stuff in the past that has been constructive criticism, and that is valid stuff to send us, and we have gotten a number of them in the past, and we've only benefited from it.
Oh, yeah.
Right. It's only been something that has helped make us better, because there's weird little ticks that we have done or things that we have said, and off air, folks may not realize it, but we've had long discussions of figuring out how to make sure certain things happen that are better for the show. So this is a very positive thing, and I really appreciate it.
Now we know not to talk about the Civil War.
No, I mean, you know, we don't know, like, you know, there's so much that we're a fairly new podcast. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're like a year in. We do this for fun. And, you know, we're getting a fairly good response.
But occasionally we're going to put our foot in it.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit.
That you guys let us know when we do things.
Absolutely.
Because
you know, we're in a bubble.
Yep. Yeah. A little bit.
We're in a little bit of a bubble.
Okay, so anyway, that's it. Again, Crary, thanks a lot for your email, which I, again, think was very thoughtful and intelligent. Appreciate it. And feel free to write us again, too. All right, so for Thinking Sideways, the podcast, this is good night.
Really? That's what you're going to do?
I can't.
All right, let's do it again.
Okay, well, this is Steve, and I'm just going to say goodbye.
Hey, guys. Why do white girls travel in packs of odd numbers?
Why?
Because they literally can't even.
Oh.
Just like I can't right now.
God. Please, somebody turn off the recording.
Oh, so what did the five fingers say to the face?
Nope.
Slap.